Hi friends, it's Brittany. Before we dive into today's episode, I have a quick ask for you. I need your help. I'm doing a short listener survey to get to know you a little bit better. Who's tuning in? What do you love? And how I can keep Conscious Pathways fresh, meaningful, and aligned with what you need. It won't take more than 5 minutes, and your feedback means so much to me. It helps me grow and helps this podcast to grow with you. You'll find the link in the show notes, and I would be so grateful if you took a moment to share your thoughts. Thanks for being here. Thanks for listening. And now let's get into the episode. Imagine walking into a classroom where every student feels seen, valued, celebrated for who they are. Not just as learners, but as individuals with rich, complex identities. Sounds like a dream, right? Well, today we're diving into how to make that dream a reality. Welcome to Conscious Pathways. I'm your host, Brittany Carey, and this is the podcast all about the intersection of education and social justice, helping parents and teachers create spaces where kids can actually thrive. Today, I am thrilled to be joined by Kwame Sarfo Minsa, founder of Identity Talk Consulting and author of Learning to Relearn, Supporting Identity in a Culturally Affirming Classroom. Kwame is a nationally recognized speaker, consultant, advocate who has dedicated his career to empowering teachers and amplifying voices of students of color. In this episode, we'll uncover how centering student identity can transform classrooms, build bridges between home and school, and support the overall well-being of children. So whether you're a parent, a teacher, an educational leader, this conversation is packed with insights and actionable steps to bring culturally relevant practices into your work. Before we get started, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a rating or review for Conscious Pathways. It really does help the show to grow and reach more listeners just like you. I'm on a road to reach 1,000 subscribers on YouTube. Every new friend counts. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you never miss a new episode of Conscious Pathways. Are you ready to reimagine education? Let's jump into it. Hi, and welcome to Conscious Pathways. Today, I am joined by Kwame. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Brittany. It's an honor to be here.
It's an honor to have you. You have such a great background and list, and I'm so excited to get into all the beautiful things that you do and have done. To kick us off, can you tell me a little bit about how you got your start in education?
Sure. So I didn't start off wanting to be a teacher. I wanted to get into sports. I wanted to be in the NBA, the NFL, Major League Baseball. That was my thing. But then when I got to high school and I realized, well, you're 5'10 and you're weighing a wet 160 pounds, you're not going to get a lot of D1 scholarships. At that point, I decided to pivot to a different career path. But even at that point, it wasn't education. I just went into mathematics because that's what I was good at. So I actually majored in math at Tubby University during my undergrad years. And it was during my freshman year when I was walking on campus and I bumped into an upperclassman. Her name was Tamara Anderson. Now she's Tamara Brown because she's married. Mm-hmm. At that time, she was running a mentoring program at her dorm. And she asked me, hey, would you want to be a part of this? Because she needed some volunteers to come and mentor some young people. So I said, all right, cool. Let's do it. I didn't have anything better to do. Had a mentee who was an eighth grader. His name was Timothy Gale. And he was an eighth grader in a school district of Philadelphia, one of the schools. And we hit it off tremendously. And it was at that time where I caught that first bug of wanting to work with kids. So that was freshman year. So then my sophomore year, I got a work study job at the local YMCA where I was a after school tutor. And I started to go there 2-3 times a week to work with kids on homework and help them out with anything that they were dealing with at school. And I really started to learn about the culture of Philly, but also learn about the inequities that a lot of black and brown kids experience when they are in school. That was my first introduction to that. Over time, I stayed with that YMCA, started to work there as a direct staff member, was a camp counselor during the summer camp periods, and did that all the way through till graduation. And when I got my degree, I knew I wanted to work with kids, but I also knew that I was pretty good at math. So how can I marry those two together? And it just made sense to become a math teacher. That was what led me to want to teach, because I knew that, for one, there were very few Black male teachers, and that's still the case even today in schools. I wanted to be an exemplar for Black and brown kids to know that, hey, you don't need to go into athletics or entertainment. You could still be a superstar and be in front of the classroom, inspiring people in that way. So that was really my initial motivation for wanting to do the work. We fast forward to 17 years later, I'm still doing this work, and it's been amazing. During my time, I was a middle school math teacher for 10 years. I know you work with the little ones in early childhood. I love the little ones, but that just was not when I was in the classroom. I like my big kids. I know they're a little out there and they got their personalities, but it's an acquired taste. People have acquired taste, right? You know this.
As soon as you said, yeah, I majored in math, I was like, mm-mm. couldn't be me. Nah. Me and math, we're not friends. We don't get along. Math stays over there.
Yeah.
Every time I hear that someone teaches middle school, not only do you teach middle school, but also math. Those two things. I'm like, you're an incredible soul.
It's definitely different.
Yes, it takes a special soul to teach both of those things. And especially thinking about middle schoolers, and they already probably don't want to be there. And they're teaching them math. And probably most of them don't want to learn math. So that's you're already fighting an uphill battle at that.
That's usually the case more times than not. But then by the time we get to June, I'd won them over. It always works out that way. I'm pretty good at what I do.
I believe it. Actually, I think that's a pretty beautiful segue, because I know you've been in the classroom for years, and you've made a bit of a shift too in the work that you do. So you do some consulting and professional development. Can you tell me a little bit about that work that you do?
So when I decided to go into consulting, I was still a full-time teacher doing middle school math. And I think at that time, it was really more about just create a new path for myself, because I had been teaching full time as a lead teacher for about 9 years. I had gained a lot of experience. I had learned lessons from some of my mentors, and I wanted to find a way to share that information to other people who are coming down the pipeline, who look like me and wanted to have success. So I wrote a book called Shaping the Teacher Identity, 8 Lessons That Help Define the Teacher in You. This was my first book. I did that back in 2018. This was a book that pretty much shared a lot of information. It was meant for early career teachers, because I felt like when I started, I didn't get that kind of tutelage and I didn't have those tools necessary to get through that first year. I wanted to make sure that other people who were coming down the pipeline were able to get these tools. The book turned out to be an intriguing read for enough people, so much so that people suggested, hey, you should do workshops based around what you wrote in this book. So it started off as a lot of pro bono workshops in neighboring school districts outside of the one I was in. And that meant me taking a few sick days here and there just to get this work in and get my name out there. And that's how it started. I did that for about 4 or 5 months after I published the first book. And right before the end of the school year in 2019, I made it official as an LLC. So the name of my company is Identity Talk Consulting, a global education consulting firm that focuses on 3 pillars. We talk about anti-bias and anti-racist practices, identity-affirming education, and culturally responsive practices in our schools. I do workshops with teachers and faculty members, and I also do workshops with students, because just selfishly, that's the best part of the job, is being with the students, and that's the part that I miss more than anything since making the transition out of the classroom.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. I have been missing
being in the classroom with students. The longer that you're outside of the classroom, the more you're like, I miss the kids. I miss the day to day. Then you're in it long enough and you're like, I'm tired of this.
Yep.
It's the flip-flop. So I feel like I take a break from education and I come back and I'm revitalized. I'm refreshed. And I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Why did I ever leave? A couple years later, I'm like, okay, I'm ready to do something else for a little bit now.
Yeah. And you've had that feeling. I've had that mm-hmm. feeling. There are times where mm-hmm. you have those moments of nostalgia and then you're like, I want to go back. Mm-hmm. And then there is something that reminds you yep. of why you left in the first place. I think I'm yep. good. I'm going to stay on this side. I like where I am right now.
Yep. Exactly. There's such beauty and magic in teaching and being in the classroom. And there's those everyday moments that just feel amazing and great. But it does take wear and tear on your body, mind, and soul sometimes. So I always say it's a good idea to take a break. You can always come back. I don't see a world where education is going to go away completely. It will be there in some capacity. But circling back to those three pillars that you mentioned, anti-racism, anti-bias, and culturally responsive and culturally affirming practices, I know that's been a topic that we've been talking about a lot, especially on the podcast and in education. But can you tell me more about these practices and what they look like in the classroom?
So if you're familiar with the work of Dr. Geneva Gay, who talks about culturally responsive mm-hmm. teaching, then you know where I'm coming from. And if you want to go back further to culturally relevant pedagogy with the OG, Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings, they talk about the importance of using students' culture as a way to inform your practices as a teacher, whether we're talking how you manage behavior, how you interact with students, but also how you make decisions on curriculum and even your instructional practice. Now, we start to get into anti-bias and anti-racist practice, we're focusing on mm-hmm. intersectionality and identity. And we're talking about Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw's work with intersectionality and how she first introduced it to describe the double discrimination that Black women experience because they're being Black, because they're Black, but they're also women. So we're talking about the racism and the sexism. Now, mm-hmm. her work has expanded into the education realm, where we're starting to talk about how intersectionality is something that we should all be accounting for when making decisions in our curricula. A perfect example would be auditing books. So we've had a lot of books being banned within our country. And a lot of those books are culturally affirming. There are books featuring protagonists mm-hmm. that may be from the LGBTQIA plus communities. There may be protagonists or main characters who are Black and brown, mm-hmm. indigenous, Asian American, or Pacific Islander. Those are the books mm-hmm. being targeted and censored from our curricular plans and schools. Mm-hmm. We're trying to create spaces of belonging for all students. Think about if you're a parent, you are accounting for what your children like, who they are, their identities. And you're making decisions based on who your children are. All we're asking is that you do the same with students who may not be your blood, but you're spending 9-10 hours a day with those. They come from certain backgrounds or certain homes where mm-hmm. they follow certain culture. They may follow a certain faith and practice it. They may speak a particular language that connects them with their loved ones that may be different from what you speak, who may come from a specific ethnicity that upholds certain traditions that are relevant to who they are and are connected to how they feel. All these mm-hmm. things are important when you're doing inventory on your students. We talked about learning inventory surveys in the beginning of the school year. We talk about interest surveys. Oh, what do you mm-hmm. like? What's your favorite TV show? What's this, what's that? As you're doing those things, you also want to do some deeper conversations that touch on some of those things I've mentioned, because these are mm-hmm. the type of things that are going to strengthen your relationships with students. And also, when they see that you care about this stuff, then they're going to want to do more for you, and they respect you even more. So now you're minimizing negative and undesirable behaviors from students. You don't have to redirect them as much because they're already invested. They're sold on who you are because you're already sold on who they are as humans. And that's how it should be in every classroom.
Yes. And I see that too in early childhood as well. You're actually putting that onus, building a community. So it's not just, I built the beautiful classroom. It looks beautiful. It's, how are you cultivating community? How are we incorporating the families that are a part of this community? And what do they celebrate? What do they like? When I do trainings with early childhood educators as well, we constantly are always focusing on those more kind of visible traits of culture that you can see. Like, what foods do you eat? What music do you listen to? What holidays do you celebrate? All very important aspects of our culture, the way we celebrate, the language we use, all very important. But there's also these other deeply rooted parts of our culture that are integral to how we show up every day that you don't get unless you're asking questions. You don't get that deep, culturally rich information unless you're genuinely showing an interest in the families and in the students in your classroom. And when you start showing that interest, like you said, you're getting that buy-in. Once they know that you genuinely care about this information, you're not going to use it against them. You're not going to just ask them all this information and then never do anything with it. I genuinely want you to be a part of our community. And how can we make this better? What are you looking for? What do you need? What's important to you? The more we ask those questions and get to the heart and the root of that cultural thing, it does make the classroom so much more rich. And even if you have a classroom that is very homogenous, everyone benefits when we talk about culture. Everyone benefits when we talk about what's important to us and the things going on at home and how things differ between person to person. Everyone benefits from that. It's not just one person benefiting from it. It's the whole classroom community gets to see the richness of culture and see how the world gets to shape around them. It's a very beautiful experience once we do those things. I know one thing, teachers have a lot going on. So how do we incorporate these types of practices without it feeling like an extra task?
But I think we have to reframe that. These aren't tasks. That's the problem. We look at these practices as tasks when really these should be living parts of your classroom culture. It's a mindset that we should develop. Just like when we talk about restorative practices, it's not a toolkit. Being restorative is a mindset. Being restorative is a commitment to ensuring that there's peace, respect, and dignity within your classroom in all aspects. That's not something that requires you to pull out something from a toolkit. That's something that you embody as a human. And I will say the same for all the other things we've mentioned, whether we're talking about anti-bias, anti-racist practice, culture-responsive teaching, identity-affirming practices. It's all a mindset. In its simplest form, it's really about what can I do in my classroom to ensure that every single student, regardless of where they come from, regardless of what they bring to the table, they feel welcomed, they feel honored, they feel like stars. How do I make sure that every kid is welcome and they feel at home? That is the goal every single year. When I asked that question, I didn't make one mention about race, gender, or sexual orientation. I just simply said, what can we do within our classrooms to ensure that every student feels honored, welcomed, and affirmed, regardless of who they are? That should be the question we ask ourselves at the beginning of each year. And then the next question is, what can I do to ensure that I sustain this culture from September or August all the way through to May or June, whenever your school year ends? What can I do to sustain this? So that we can keep this momentum going, this positive momentum.
Yes. I love that you mentioned it being a mindset. When we think of these practices as another task, another thing, another additional ask that someone is having us do on top of the myriad of things as educators that we have to do inside and outside the classroom, then yeah, it does feel daunting. It feels it's another thing I have to do. But when we take it as a mindset shift. It's a thing that we are actually embodying in our classroom. It is a thing that we are embodying as a community together, as an entire school community, that it's not just a tool that I could pick up and use sometimes and then put it away and until it gets dusty in the corner, that this is actually an essence of my being, an essence of the way that I exist, and an essence of the way that our students exist, right? Just as I don't show up in my classroom as a blank, empty slate. I don't just shed my culture right as I enter the classroom. You're like, oh, I'm going to leave that outside. That's not the way I show up. That's not the way most people show up. That's not the way our students show up. They show up as their whole authentic selves. It is our role as the educators and the adults and the parents who are working with students and children to make sure that we are honoring the wholeness of the way that they are authentically and the way that they show up, and that we're not trying to dim their fire in any way. We want their fire to shine. We want them to be individuals. We want them to be a part of our community. And the best way that we can do that is by our own practices and looking at ourselves. And I think that kind of goes into that anti-bias. A whole lot to me with anti-bias is reflection and looking at my own self, my thoughts, my opinions, my judgments. I need to get really clear about where I'm coming from before I can start implementing these things in the classroom, right? If I'm trying to implement anti-racist practices in my classroom, but I myself am walking around full of bias, we're going to have issues.
Yeah.
Not saying that bias is inherently wrong. Everyone has bias. We're human beings.
That's right.
It's developmental. It's what we've developed to do. But unless I am very clear and honest with myself about the biases that I have and I'm actively working on and actively reflecting, like having a reflective practice is such an important aspect of this work, that you can't do this work without being reflective on your practices and reflective on you.
That's number one. And as you're mentioning the importance of reflection, in my newest book, Learn to Relearn, Supporting Identity, a Culturally Affirming Classroom, I have a chapter focused on that very thing. It's called Start the Work with You. That's chapter 6. And what it's about is, okay, what are the biases and stereotypical notions that I hold of different communities that are different from who I am, right? And how do those thoughts and perspectives inform the way that I view the world, inform the way that I interact with different students, inform the way that I approach curriculum, and even inform some of the policies that we uphold within our schools? So really doing a full audit and also looking back at our own childhood experiences and seeing how some of those moments in our upbringing inform the way that we look at other people who are different from us. And what I've come to realize is that many people should go to therapy in order to unpack some of these biases that they hold about certain people, because more times than not, it ties to some kind of traumatic experience, or it may tie to a moment where they heard a family member say something derogatory about a particular group of people. And because you're young, you just took it at face value. You just stayed in that echo chamber because that was the rhetoric around you. And that tends to happen quite a bit, not just in the United States, but even other parts of the globe where we get stuck in these echo chambers and we believe what people say, as opposed to looking past what people are saying and coming to our own conclusions and perspectives about what these things are. And that's more of the spirit that I want people to inherit, especially when they read the book. What can I do to get past some of those echo chambers in order to have original thoughts about these very complicated and nuanced issues that we talk about when it comes to identity?
Yeah. And that's a beautiful suggestion to look into therapy, look into community, because it's hard and next to impossible to do this work alone, to do this work in a silo, if you don't have a community of people who are, one, holding you accountable for what you say you want to do, right? And holding you accountable for that. But also, it's hard to get other thoughts and opinions, and it's hard to really synthesize this information and to really understand, where does this bias stem from? It's hard to do that work on your own, and having someone else who is a supportive person alongside you with you doing that, whether that's a therapist, whether that's a community, looking at how can I find support in this? Because it's hard work.
Yes.
It is hard work. I've done my own work on my own biases, and this is not easy. No, we're not by any means saying this is a walk in the park, that you're just going to wake up one day and be like, oh, I decided to be anti-bias today. So we're good.
Yeah.
No, it's got work. You got to break down some walls. You got to break down some really tough patterns of thought, right? And for most of us, this isn't something that we've been taught or have been learning since we were kids. That's something in my field of work that I seek to change, introducing these topics to children early so they don't have to do this when they're 30 years old. But most of us weren't given those tools and weren't taught these things and weren't given the resources to understand how bias and systemic racism and injustice and inequity. We weren't really given the tools to understand these things. And so having someone in your corner as you're doing that work is so, so, so
good. I actually have a question for you, but I also want to add on to what you mentioned, because the name of the book is Learn to Relearn. It's called Learn to Relearn for a reason, because that was the very process I had to go through to get this book done. I'm sitting here as a cis hetero black male talking about other communities that I'm not a part of. I'm talking about indigenous and native people. I'm talking about Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. I'm talking about Latinx people throughout all parts of the diaspora. I'm talking about black folks. I'm talking about people who are queer, who are trans. I'm talking about people who have intellectual disabilities. I can't be the spokesperson for all these different communities. There's no way that I can be that. So I have to check my biases. I had to be called in several times throughout this process in order to get the story right. If it wasn't for the sensitivity reads, if it wasn't for the peer reviews, if it wasn't for the trusted counsel from different colleagues of mine and friends who are from these different communities I speak of, this book will not get to the finish line, because there's so much diversity within those communities. It's not just diversity in their phenotypes or physical appearance or the language. I'm talking about diversity in thought. People think because you're from this community, you all think the same. But the reality is, it's a spectrum of thoughts. You have to account for that when you are talking about different stories, but also you are bringing up specific terms or language that you want people to learn. Some people don't embrace those terms in the same way that others do. And that's going to a deeper conversation. But my question for you, Brittany, is as someone that taught kindergartners, preschool kids, early childhood students, so often we hear teachers in that space say, these are kids who are 4, 5, 6 years old. How can we possibly talk about anti-bias, anti-racist issues when they're this young? So what would you say to teachers who say that?
Yeah, and I hear that a lot. I do hear that sentiment a lot, that we should just, there's so little, these topics are so big, let them be kids and they can worry about that when they get older. But the thing is, that misses so much of how young children actually learn. The bulk of their early learning, they are looking around them. They want to know how their world works. They want to know about the people they see. They want to know about the sounds they hear. They want to learn these different things. So if you've ever had a conversation with a young child, even as young as 2 to 3 years old, they're asking questions. They're curious. They're asking, where's so-and-so's dad? They might see two moms drop off and like, where's their dad? And that could be a simple, innocuous question. And you might just blow it off like, oh, whatever. They're just being inappropriate. But no, they're observing that. Usually I see people who have a mom dad in my community, yep. Right? I haven't seen their dad. Where is their dad? They're curious about that. And that opens the door to have conversations, right? We don't have to go deep into, well, this is what homosexuality means, son, right? But they're asking questions about how the world works. And that's a great opening way of saying, you know what? Sometimes families look different. And we could talk about how families look different. Sometimes families have one mommy. Sometimes they have one daddy. Sometimes they have two daddies. Sometimes they don't have a mommy or daddy. Sometimes they just have a grandma or an auntie or an uncle, right? Those are just ways that we open the door for conversations that they can start to understand. And the older they get, you'll start to see that when you involve children in these questions about social justice, injustice in general, if they're seeing in their community that there's a lot of homeless people, they might have questions about that. And again, we could say, they're too young to understand social inequity and the economy. And they don't need to know those finite line of details, but they do have ideas. They do have questions. And if you involve them in those conversations about some people don't have a home, why do you think that is? Or what we could do about that? They'll have ideas. They can be involved in that. And you could turn that into an entire social studies conversation, right? That could be part of your curriculum. We're thinking about people who don't have homes, people who don't have beds to sleep in. And now they're starting to think about these things in deeper and more philosophical ways. It's all about introducing these social justice pedagogies and conversations to them. We don't have to talk about these really intense conversations like school shootings and things like that. We can introduce topics to them that they're already curious about in ways that is developmentally appropriate, in ways that involves them in that, right? Because if we don't talk about it at all, now they're going to be in later adolescenthood. And when you start thinking about their brains are developing, your brain gets to about its full size by the time you're 5 years old. A lot of the things like children's thinking is so black and white. But unless we are actively incorporating ideas and helping them to understand bias, by the time they're 5 years old, they've already have bias that is ingrained into their brains, the way they think. And so it's going to take much more work at that point to break down those thought processes that have already been ingrained in their heads. When we could do that as a kid, we could introduce them to these thoughts and ideas and questions. And you don't have to have all of the answers. I think people sometimes go into this work thinking, I have to know everything and I don't know everything. You don't have to know everything.
No.
One of the most beautiful things you can say to a child is, you know what? I don't know enough about that. Let's go look it up together. Now we're learning about something together, and that's exciting. It's an opportunity for us to grow as community and to build a culture of being passionate about each other and being curious about each other. We can do that in early childhood. It's the most perfect time. There's no better time to do that than in early childhood.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is why we need to pay attention to these book bans, because the best access points for young children, particularly early childhood children, are children's books. You want to broach conversations about these very complex issues, children's books can do that for you in a way that's developmentally appropriate. Mm. Do you know what one of my favorite son's books is? Entangle Makes what? Three. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Entangle Makes Three.
No, I'm not familiar with that one.
So Entangle Makes Three is a children's book that focuses on two male penguins who are very close to each other, in love with each other, and they end up having a child. It's a story that talks about the importance of looking at different families that are outside what we consider the traditional family. And we're talking about two male penguins, but we're not mentioning homosexuality. We're just talking about two male penguins that have a deep affection for each other and are caring for another baby penguin. That's the story. Mm-hmm. And that's a way for them to see that, hey, not every family has a mommy and a daddy. So we're breaking that binary thinking just through the access of a children's book. Yeah. Now, the other thing I want to mention is the questions. We want the questions, because indoctrination is a term that gets thrown out there. Everybody wants to co-opt it and say that everything's indoctrination. But the fact that we're born into a society that's informed by white dominant culture is indoctrination in itself. The very traditions and the customs that we consider to be the norm, that we consider to be acceptable in society, is a form of indoctrination. The fact that we whitewash the history of black and brown communities is a form of indoctrination. But yet, when we're trying to do the antithesis of that, which is to bring about culturally affirming and identity affirming curriculum that speaks to the invisibilized communities, then all of a sudden we're indoctrinated. The reason why the questions are important is because that allows for students to start to build their own agency around these topics, encouraged to do their own research and not just listen to what we have to say. So there's a value in being able to say, I don't know. That indirectly lets them know that I'm going to find out and come back with an answer. And now we can have that learning moment together as a classroom community. Yep. We need more inquiry-based thinking. Let's interrogate what's around us. Let's be more inquisitive, like you mentioned. Let's be more curious about things that are happening around us. Because kids know when something seems off. Usually they pose a question because they know that what they're seeing doesn't quite align to what should be happening at that moment. We need to honor that.
Yep. We need to honor that. Diversity already exists in the world, right? So we're actually doing a disservice by not talking about it and not bringing it up. I always think back to this one conversation I was having with a parent, and her son was in an inclusion school. So there were kids with Down syndrome and autism, and they're all in the same classroom together with neurotypical children. And she was talking about the program. She was like, yeah, it's so great. My son doesn't even know that his friends are autistic. Isn't that amazing? And I'm like, well, no. Right? That's a part of the way this child exists in their everyday life. They're not going to wake up tomorrow and not be autistic. A child with Down syndrome is not going to wake up tomorrow and not have Down syndrome. There's nothing wrong with that, right? That's just the way that they exist. And so when we're not talking about these things in the classroom, we're not elevating the beautiful richness of the diversity in our classroom, the way that our perspectives are different, the way we think are different, our families are different. If we don't do that and we just say, we just don't talk about that, right? It doesn't make them not exist. It just makes them exist quietly, right? And that's not a society I want to live in, where my identity needs to be quieted to make other people feel more comfortable around me. And I know that's not a world or society that most people want to live in either. That's the beautiful thing about incorporating these practices into our everyday, having it be something that we work through as a community and as a society, because there's beauty in that. And so that leads me to my next question for you, which is, how do you reimagine education?
How do I reimagine it? So this is the freedom dream. This is the radical dream right here.
Yes.
And we both in Black. I love it. How do I reimagine it? I see an education system that generally allows for students to have real input on decisions that are made on their behalves. I see an education system that distances itself from paternalism and allows for students to be co-curators of their educational experience. An education system that not just has teacher unions, but real student unions. Because students should be able to file grievances against teachers who are committing injustices and infractions against them. Just like how teachers are able to go to a union to file a grievance against an administrator or a colleague, students should have that same right. Because guess what? We do this work, or we should be doing this work for them and because of them. So why not have student unions? Like, I would love to see that. Not a student council, a real union where they have decision-making power and a form of executive presence when it comes to town hall meetings, meetings that deal with budgets, meetings that deal with things that will directly impact their quality of learning. I want to see that. I want to see an education system that is not anti-Black.
Yes, please.
An education system that embraces everybody for who they are. They're not asking questions about why they look like this, why they speak like this, why their hair is the way it is, why they're as dark as they are. Yeah. Just accept them for who they are. Accept them as they come. Let people come as they are, so they can learn just like every. So those are just a few thoughts that come to my mind when I think about this reimagination of our education systems within the States, but other parts of the globe.
Yes. The idea of having a student union, a functioning part of the school community where students actually have voice. And like you said, not the illusion of voice, like they actually have voice and can affect change. And that is what justice is. That is what power is, right? Is when you have the ability to see change and make change and advocate for that. think of the world we could have if all students got to be a part of something like that, if they got to see the effect of being a part of a collective and being able to advocate for each other and what they want and need. Just imagine the beauty that you would have. We know that in the United States, and I'm sure in other parts of the world too, education is still very highly segregated. If you have money to go to a more elite school with more resources, you can do that. Children who live below the poverty line don't really get that choice. You go to the school next to you, whatever that is. It creates deep segregation and divides amongst students, the haves and the have-nots. And oftentimes you see students who are part of those more elite schools, they have a more freedom choice and their voice means something and their voice can affect change in their communities. Whereas in schools that don't have as much funding, you don't see the freedom. You don't see those things. And they operate essentially as mini prisons, essentially. And it is in this highly segregated context, see these inequities and you see it. And right, I'm imagining, again, that freedom dream. I'm imagining those students who everyone now has access to being able to file their grievances to say, this isn't working for me. This is how I want to see the education system work. And they're actually an active participant in that. I've always seen education as something that is very dynamic. Everyone gets to be a part of it. It is not something that just happens to you, similar to development. Your development isn't something that just happens to you. You are an active part of your own development, and the people around you are an active part of your own development. And so I love that. That's something that's making my brain all happy right now.
Yes.
So where can my audience find you? I know you mentioned you have your books. Where can my audience find you if they're interested in learning more?
Sure. They can go to my main website, which is identitytalk4educators.com. They'll learn more about my services and offerings. You'll be able to find my podcast there, as well as the different books I've written, including my newest one, Learning to Relearn, Support Identity in a Culture-Affirming Classroom. It is out right now, 20% off at all book retailers. This is a good holiday read to engage in during your winter break, if you're stateside. And even if you're in an international school and you're on holiday, you could also access it. So make sure you do that. If you're still unsure about whether you want to get a copy, you could go to the book's website, which is learning2relearn.com. You'll be able to get more of an overview of what the book's about.
And I'll put all of that in my show notes below. So if you're curious on checking out the book or you're curious in checking out any of the other beautiful things that Kwame is a part of, you can check that out right there. Kwame, I want to thank you so much for joining me and sharing all of this beautiful knowledge. This conversation has been heartwarming and enlightening, especially the way that you've reimagined education. I love that. I'm manifesting that into reality as we speak.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Brittany, for having me once again. It's always good to be on the other side, being able to share my story and have good dialogue with people who are also in this space. So I appreciate you.
Yeah, I love this podcast for that very reason. I just get to talk to really cool people doing amazing things out there in the world, elevating their stories so other people can hear this too. I want to thank you so much for joining me and being here and all the great work you do.
Yes. And then for those who are listening, please make sure after you listen to not just this episode, but past episodes of the Conscious Pathways podcast, leave a review on Apple Podcasts. As a podcaster, we value those reviews. We love the affirmations and DMs. Those are great.
Yes.
But we need to put those reviews in these official platforms so other people can know how amazing these platforms are, especially ones featuring Black women.
What's
Make sure
that?
Y'all support Brittany. And once again, I appreciate you for having me on. And I hope we can do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You're always welcome. You're a friend of the pod now. So you're always welcome to come on. And thank you. Please leave a rating or review. It does help.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you so much for listening to Conscious Pathways. I want to know what your biggest takeaway from this conversation with Kwame was. There were so many beautiful takeaways and points. I loved hearing his feedback on the importance of culturally rich classrooms and how it's not another task, that it's actually just a way of being. It's a way, it is the way we show up in our classroom. It's not a checkbox. It is our work, the work that we do. And there's a lot of inner work and a lot of inner components that go into making our work a reality.
But I want to know what your takeaway was. What's something that you learned in this episode? What questions do you have? If you're on YouTube, put those in the comments and I will reply to them. Don't forget to subscribe to my newsletter so you can know when my conscious community will be launching. And until then, navigate your conscious journey with courage and kindness. And I'll see you there for more transformative conversations. Bye! If you're like me, you believe in the power of education and social justice. And what's more powerful than a good book? Today, I want to share an incredible way for you to support local independent bookstores while you indulge in your love of reading. Have you ever heard of bookshop.org? They're an amazing platform that connects readers just like us to independent booksellers all around the world. Local bookstores are essential for our communities. They foster culture, curiosity, and a lifelong love of reading. But they need our support to thrive, especially in this age of e-commerce giants. Bookshop.org is committed to helping those bookstores flourish. Every purchase you make on their site financially supports independent bookstores. That's right, every single purchase. They provide these stores with the tools they need to compete online and maintain their vibrant presence in our neighborhoods. They put their mission and public good above financial interests, giving over 80% of their profit margin to independent bookstores. That's a commitment you don't see every day. In fact, in 2020, they were recognized as the best of the world by B Labs, ranking in the top 5% of all B corporations. And guess what? It's written into their government's documents that they will never sell the company to Amazon or any major retailer. That's dedication to their mission. Plus, as a climate-neutral company, they're committed to operating sustainably, another reason to feel good about your purchases. So if you're looking to buy a book and make a positive impact, head over to bookshop.org and use my affiliate link that's linked in my show notes below. By doing so, you'll be supporting local bookshops and helping them thrive. Let's make a difference one book at a time. Happy reading, and thank you for supporting our local bookshops.